Leading off today, Bill Resnick interviews Richard Smith, a China expert who has written a lot on China's explosive politics and economic development, including his books include China's Communist Capitalist Ecological Apocalypse and Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. And now he's finishing a book on China and the environment. The provocative subject of the interview, Can China Save What Is Loosely Known as Civilization? Bill?
Hi, Richard Smith. Welcome to KABU.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Richard Smith is a China expert. It's explosive politics and economic development. He's written a lot, including China's Communist Capitalist Ecological Apocalypse and Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. He's now finishing a book on China and the environment. Richard, Trump has pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Accord. Immediately after that, China and Germany announced that they would assume leadership of the planetary response to climate change. These two countries positioning themselves as the leaders of the international community in saving the planet. So, Richard Smith, what do you make of Paris, the U.S. pullout, and whether China can save what is loosely known as civilization?
China's civilization, yeah, a police state civilization, yeah, right, great. Well, Bill, there are a number of issues you raised there. I don't quite know what to say about Trump's pullout and the effect of the U.S. just yet, but I'll say something about China, which is that Xi Jinping is trying to project China's image as a normal country, and particularly he's able to make that particularly effective message against this buffoon we have as a president in this country, so that's nice. But in fact, the chances of China leading any kind of move to prevent climate change are remote. And that's because for a number of reasons. But first of all, in China, the government has to maximize growth in a way which is kind of beyond capitalist rational in the West. And that's kind of the subject of my book on China. The point is that China has a collective ruling class. It's a party bureaucratic ruling class, and it makes it very difficult for them, for leaders like Xi Jinping, who has very good reason. Lots of people in their government have very good reason to want to cut coal consumption and so forth, particularly coal, but fossil fuels in general. However, they cannot do so very much because there is tremendous resistance in the system to that. That's one reason. And secondly, because Xi Jinping himself is meeting China's maximizing growth effort with all kinds of programs to create sort of innovative industrial development in China, make China relatively self-sufficient in high tech, and to push China to the leadership of, he wants to make China explicitly the technological leader of the world economy. He has a program called the New Silk Road Initiative to bring some 60 governments in Southeast Asia, South Asia, all the way to Europe, into a trade alliance with China in which China will be able to sell them all kinds of infrastructure and so forth like that in return for extracting their minerals and forests and that sort of thing. So what you have in China is a kind of excessive growth model based on the needs of the bureaucracy, which are twofold. First of all, it was originally a communist party, and it has a need to maximize employment in a way which capitalist countries don't. Like in the West, you know, there are masses of unemployed people. Companies lay off workers. That's not the company's problem. It's not even the government's problem, unless it's an emergency like the Great Depression. It's not really their problem. But in China, this is a problem. The Chinese government cannot allow masses of unemployed people to exist in China, and therefore it makes every effort to get them reemployed when they get laid off by companies, either by state companies or private companies. The government makes huge efforts to make sure people are employed, even if that means having them build stuff that nobody wants. Like they produce steel, overproduce steel, more than China can use. Like they produce 30% more steel than they can consume, than China can consume. And they dump it on the world market at below cost. Well, why is this rational? It's rational, and aluminum too, and many other commodities like cars and so forth. And why is this rational? It's rational because in that system, you need to keep people working. It's better to have them making steel and aluminum that just sits, getting piled up. There's a huge pile, like 6% of the world's production of aluminum ingots is sitting in a desert in Mexico. They tried to sneak it into the U.S. because there are quotas on Chinese aluminum imports. So they parked it in Mexico, trying to sneak it in as Mexican production. Moved more in Vietnam, same deal. And they dumped steel in the world markets at below cost. It may be irrational. No capitalist company would do that. They couldn't justify that to their shareholders.
And they're building cities that nobody wants to live in. So you have vast numbers of apartment towers all over the country that are uninhabited and just sort of decaying.
It makes sense for the government to keep people employed, whether they're producing steel or aluminum or ghost cities. I mean, right now, there's in plans and in construction homes for 3.4 billion people in China. That's what's on the drawing boards and what's under construction right now in China. There are only 1.3 billion people in China. Apartments have become just a source of investment, speculative investment for the middle class in China. And it makes sense for the government to promote the middle class, to keep them happy, to find some, because they mostly they can't invest their money out of the country. That's difficult for them. Although many middle class and upper class people are trying to get money out of the country illegally, but that's difficult to do. So they plow their money into buying apartments. So most middle class families in Chinese cities, or many, have three or four apartments. These are not vacation apartments. These are not. They're not. Nobody's going to live there. They're just speculative investments, as much like you would put money in the stock market. We put money in the stock market too, but the stock market is very limited in China. And it's really not really a stock market, kind of a toy stock market, but that's another subject. Anyway, so it makes sense for them to keep this over-construction going and also to move out and sell this stuff, sell their commodities, their excess steel and all their plastic junk and whatnot to Africa and Asia and so forth like this, and push this overproduction outside and also push their employees outside. So like more than a million Chinese have migrated to Australia and another million to Africa, at least a million. And the big state-owned industries go to these countries and they sell infrastructure projects in Africa, for example, to build railways and dams and power plants and this, that, and the other, and open up mines to extract minerals to ship back to China, and also building a steel plant here and there in Africa to produce steel on site. So they're pushing their overproduction out of the country, and they're pushing their workers out of the country because there are too many workers and too much infrastructure construction in China. It's just so massively overbuilt already. They've overbuilt not just the cities, but the dams and the highways. They have a huge highway system, express highway system, much larger than the American interstate system. But, you know, half these highways are empty because outside of the big corridors around Beijing or Shanghai or Guangzhou, places like that, there are highways all over the western part of the country. They're empty. People dry their crops on them. But it's useful to keep people busy to build this stuff.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on cable radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Richard Smith, who studies the development, the explosive development of the Chinese economy. His thesis is that that China cannot possibly be a world leader in saving the environment, in that they are a state that survives and a communist party that survives through the mechanism of continuous and eruptive and enormous growth, including the smelting of enormous piles of metal just to keep people employed, as well as ghost cities all over China and highways on which nobody drives. And furthermore, as you pointed out earlier, they are now doing a program of rural automobile expansion, trying to get rural people to buy more cars and then to create even more highways, at least local systems. So China is not going to stop, and they're doing it with coal, but even if they tried to do it with solar, I mean, if they substituted for the coal plants huge solar and wind turbine plantations, which they are doing at some level already, they are just hooked into growth, 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 and stimulating more extraction of materials and more pollution.
Yeah, and more useless consumption. I mean, China, it's, so far as the renewable energy sector goes, China is the world's leading builder of wind turbines and solar panels. It also leads the world in installed capacity, solar and wind. And yet, wind power accounts for less than 4% of power generated in China, and solar barely 1%. Why is that? Well, that's because the collected ruling class of China includes huge ministries, the coal ministry, the railway industry, the oil ministry, and so forth. And these ministries have millions of employees, and they have those vested interests to deal with. So Xi Jinping may want to promote renewable energy, and he does. And in fact, people are happy to build these plants all over the place. But it's a very fragmented economy because of the nature of the way the system was set up in the 1950s.
Not to mention the fact that they're building up their army, and the army itself has billions and billions and billions of workers in it. And Army ministry is also interested in growing and growing.
And the thing about coal, to kind of come back to the U.S. and so forth, and the larger question about energy consumption is that coal and oil are available 24/7. Wind and solar, not so much. So it's a problem for any country, even Germany or the U.S., because of the sporadic nature of power production and the inability so far of energy producers to come up with a tech solution to energy storage.
Well, storage is getting a lot cheaper as well, and when the Chinese get into it, it will get even further cheaper. That's my hypothesis, at least.
That's possible. But then the larger question is, well, what do you use this energy for? If you just use more electricity, free, non-polluting electricity, doesn't that just, on the Jevons principle, just encourage more consumption of electricity, in particular for production of stuff that people don't really need? You know, we have an economy, a capitalist economy, of endless invention of trivial junk that no one really needs, whether it's 3D printers or hoverboards or drones or the latest next thing. You know, as the Lorax used to say, the next need. THNEED.
And always, of course, McMansions after McMansion. This is for the top 40%. There's a lot of people in this country that are perennially, constantly hungry and without medical care. But
right.
That's a whole.
Right.
That's another story. But the privilege of the industrialized West make for enormous amounts of consumption of everything, and of China and parts of Asia. I have a hypothesis. China is not going to change, but the world is going to change. If you believe the climate scientists, and I do, and I know you do, then we're going to begin moving, and right now we're already there, and it could be very soon, an enormous climate crisis, one cataclysmic storm after another. And at some point, when Long Island is under the waters, and much of South Florida and Louisiana, not to mention the California coast, much of parts of China, Bangladesh, all the low-lying areas, and there are many of them in Southeast Asia, the destruction and then failures of production of food, all of that is going to hit. And if it's not too late, it seems to me there will be a mobilization. People will wake up. There's going to be a mass support for, in fact, doing something about it. It seems to me right now we're in a position where it seems inevitable that climate cataclysms are going to occur. Inevitable is too strong a word, but very likely. It seems to me that the cheapness of solar panels and wind turbines, and the fact that there are lots and lots of small producers and small installment companies who are now working, or enterprises rather, some are co-ops, who are working in lots and lots of cities now, and some in California even, where you're getting these local energy grids such that you could have enough energy to run a successful society, even modern society, if you really cut back on production of useless stuff enormously. It seems to me that's the hope of the future, is that at some point the mobilization will occur, and the mobilization and the left will lead it rather than a corporate right, which is possible. They'll be contesting for power at that time. That's my hypothesis. Why don't you comment on that?
Well, the basic problem we have in capitalist economies everywhere around the world is that in order to do what we need to do to save the humans, to save the planet, means that we have to take actions to suppress fossil fuel consumption, and not just fossil fuel production and so forth, but consumption, all the industries that are based on fossil fuels. So you're talking about autos, airplanes, airlines, tourism, chemicals, plastics, construction, and on and on and on. If we need, scientists tell us we need to suppress fossil fuel consumption to almost zero by 2050 if we hope to prevent global warming spinning out of control. And the only way to do that is to suppress it. But if you suppress it, that means you're talking about throwing millions of people out of work, not to mention making a lot of capitalist investors unhappy. So even if you could get around the problem of the capitalist investors, you have to have a plan for the workers. So what do you do when you cut back production and lay off masses of people? That's why every year there are climate negotiations, but they always end up in acrimony and collapse because no government on Earth will accept a decline in the rate of growth in order to save the planet. So if we carry on at this pattern for the next few decades, then it'll just be too late. So what I argued in my Green Capitalism, The God That Failed book and articles and so forth, and also in China, is that what we need is a radical, significant deindustrialization. We need to close down all kinds of industries that are polluting and over-consuming resources and so forth. But that the only way we can do that is to create a different kind of economy, an eco-socialist economy that can actually provide jobs for people. It's not good enough to just tell the workers, well, you need a job training program for a few weeks and tell coal miners and oil workers, go get retraining for a while and become a computer jockey. Good luck on that. That's not working in China any more than it does in the U.S. What you need is an economy that can actually provide people other jobs, guaranteed jobs, at reasonable remuneration, comparable to what they're getting. Otherwise, if you don't have an economy that can do that, then people will unavoidably, necessarily, keep pushing to keep their jobs at the expense of the environment. In other words, they will keep destroying their children's future to hang on to their jobs today. This is just completely insane. More and more people understand this, but under capitalism, they don't have a choice. So the only way to give people that kind of choice is to propose creating a different kind of economy, not a capitalist economy, but nationalize and socialize the big industries and dismantle, repurpose them, reprioritize them, close down the ones we have to close down, and take those resources and put them into other things we do need.
Richard, I think that's right. But how do we get to that point where we have the power to take over, nationalize, that is, take over those industries to change things very radically, as well as the cities, and provide jobs for people? And it seems to me that World War II in the United States provides some example when we did, in fact, nationalize the auto industry. There were years when none were produced. All they were producing, of course, was tanks and planes and all the rest of it, war armaments. But they could have been producing clean energy devices, and all of the other industries under public control would be forced to radically cut back, and workers would be employed in reconstructing the infrastructure, that part of some of which would be destroyed, and repurposing the infrastructure and repurposing all of our productive facilities, as well as, of course, agriculture, very radically changed. It does seem to me that the point at which we can imagine that transformation is when people wake up to the threat. And right now, they're passive, basically, on the environment. But when cataclysms occur, hopefully before the climate crisis becomes absolutely irreversible and the world starts baking to death, it seems to me that's the mechanism through which we could imagine the kind of reconstruction that you were talking about.
Well, I would say, yeah, you're right. I honestly don't have a clear strategy, and I don't have, you know, any sort of crystal ball. But what I was just saying is that the left has a responsibility to project a vision of an alternative possible society and to fight for every democratic kind of change that we can do to democratize whatever we can. I just see the strategy has to be the most radical democratization of getting people's control over the economy and society as much as they can, because that's what we're looking for. We're looking for an end and means which are the same. That is, we want to get to a democratic, bottom-up, planned economy, and we need to do that through democratic means. And I just think, yeah, people will see the need for change, but people on the left need to projecting a radical alternative vision of a possible, plausible eco-socialist society, because otherwise people don't know what to fight for. If nobody's putting out any kind of alternative vision of a different kind of society, then what's the point of fighting? You may as well go on with capitalism. That's my sense. And,
right.
You know, I'm trying to put my little two cents into that and in my Six Theses paper in the next project, Six Theses on Saving the Planet. So people might look at that. That's my own modest contribution, but there are some other people who are contributing to this.
Right.
I think that's what we have to do.
Yeah, Richard, it seems to me what you're describing is in fact being modeled now in some places in the world, and more, it seems, in some of the cities, as in California, where those possibilities at least are arising and people are beginning to see it. I think that's the great hope. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Oh, you're certainly welcome, Bill.
Right, so long.
Oh. world, planet poor old species, as climate change will get worse. Poor old nature, poor creation, I think you've been cast by a curse. But I don't want you to die, I can see all the lies. There's nothing there that's new. But it isn't too late to get hold of our fate, and you know what I say is true. And meanwhile in the mansions and manors with style, they're praising the progress and growth. And the leaders we need are indeed paralyzed, and carping there's no other road. Poor old forests, poor old farmlessness, climate change will get worse. Poor old waters, poor old world, I think you've been cast by a curse. But you know that it's true, there is so much to do. It is no good to lie down and cry. And the day that you see, that's the day that all of your sadness and sickness will die. For the wealth we are building while wasting this earth is only causing us pain. It's disguised itself well as progress and growth, but destruction is still its name.